Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on June 5th, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Upside Down Constitution. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we have two guest speakers to discuss Dr. Michael Grieva's new book, The Upside Down Constitution. Dr. Grieva is going to speak to us about the book for some 10 to 12 minutes, after which we'll have some responsive remarks from Professor Michael Rappaport. The link to Dr. Grieva's book was provided to you in the notices you received announcing this call, but that link is also available on the Federalist Society's website. Professor Michael Rappaport is the Darling Foundation Professor at the University of San Diego School of Law, where he also serves as the Director of the Center for the Study of Constitutional Originalism. His principal areas of interest are originalism, separation of powers, supermajority rules, and federalism. Dr. Michael Grieva is the John G. Searle Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where his scholarship centers on constitutional law, federalism, and business regulation. He's very widely published on those and other subjects, and he also heads AEI's Transatlantic Law Forum. Dr. Grieva, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean, and special thanks to my buddy and co-blogger, Mike Rappaport, at the other end of the country. So here's sort of a one-sentence summary of what this book is about. It's about the fact that I think there's something very wrong with our federalism, both with the way it operates and the way the Supreme Court and lawyers think about it. And what I'm trying to do in this book is explain why that is, how that is, and how one might think about federalism in a somewhat more productive fashion. Now, discerning readers will have noticed that federalism is actually not in the title of this book, and it's not in the subtitle. As Rob Gassaway, who reviewed this book for Engage, put it, this book is actually about federalism the way Moby Dick is about a whaling voyage, because it has a sort of bigger target, and that target is the way we, and now I mean sort of lots of conservatives and libertarians, think about the Constitution and its structure. And for the most part, a lot of that is very court-centered, it's very clause-bound, and it's very rights-oriented. That's not true of everyone, obviously, but there's enough of that to deserve, I think, sort of an antidote or an argument on the other side. And that's what this book does. I mean, the way it goes about trying to understand federalism is it's not court-centered. It's much more about federalism's political economy and then goes at the doctrines. It's not clause-bound. It tries to understand the Constitution and the constitutional structure as a whole. So there's a lot of James Buchanan constitutional theory, the economist, not the president. A lot of James Buchanan in here. And it's there's very little about rights and a whole lot about the structure. So I have very little to say about God, guns, and gays, and a lot about state debt, state taxation, that sort of thing. And what I'm hoping is that once you do that, you get a more coherent view of the federal structure and a more accurate view of federalism, of American federalism, and what is currently wrong with it. Now, to ease into that, let me sort of start us on two sort of perplexities or puzzles. One is the standard story that we like to tell ourselves, which is what the problem with our federalism is excessive centralization, and to fix that problem we ought to radically decentralize stuff. And that's the story you get around Washington and from politicians and so forth. You don't get that story from the Chamber of Commerce. What people who produce things associate with federalism is state attorneys general, hellhole jurisdictions, trial lawyers, conflicting regulations imposed by 50 different jurisdictions on top of the feds and that sort of thing. And so what you have to ask yourself is it really the case that the founders gave us a federalism that that pits democratic and decentralization values consistently against producer interests, or is there something that has gone wrong with our understanding? And to my mind, the odds are it's the latter. Here's another piece of the standard story. Which runs as follows. Up until the New Deal, we had a perfectly fine federalism, and everything was hunky-dory, and then the New Deal came along, centralized everything, and it's been progressive centralization ever since. And so the task at hand is to restore, as it's often said, federalism's balance. That's the Supreme Court's watchword. And I think that's all wrong. There are long chapters in the book that explain why the New Deal is not, in fact, a centralizing revolution. Erie Railroad is not a centralizing decision. It's a decentralizing decision. You know, many, many more examples tendency. And more importantly, for present purposes at least, it's simply not true that the history of federalism since the 1930s has been a history of progressive centralization. Look at sort of own source tax revenues, which the Wall Street Journal always has this fine figure. Federal revenues as percent of GDP have moved sideways between 18% and 20% from the end of the Korean War to 2008, when all the numbers go off the rails. Over the same time frame, state and local taxes, state and local own source revenues, to be perfectly precise, have leapt from 5% of GDP to 15%. That's a tripling of own source revenues. The same picture emerges if you look at regulation. 30 years ago, no businessman worried about state regulators. That was ridiculous. Or state attorneys general, or multi-state prosecutions, or anything of the sort. Now they do worry. If you had to summarize this in one sentence, the entire growth of government in the United States, I don't mean to tell you that the federal government hasn't grown. It's just that government at all levels has grown, and the growth has been much more pronounced at the state and local level. And in terms of revenue, the entire growth has been at that level. So the standard story of progressive centralization that we like to tell ourselves is simply a crock. To sort of summarize the answer that this book gives, very quick, Prissy. What I think has gone wrong here is this. The central question, the central constitutional question, and the central political question right now is not how much federalism should we have, and are we, constitutionally speaking, supposed to have. The question is, what kind of federalism? The Constitution contains absolutely no answer to the question of what's the federal balance, or how much power should go to the feds versus the states. Lots of people in the founding era agitated for some sort of rule along those lines. They lost. And so there is no constitutional answer to the question that the Supreme Court is preoccupied with. But the Constitution does provide an answer to the question of what kind of federalism. And what the book lives off and thrives on is sort of a diametrical opposition between two kinds of federalism. Let me start with the constitutional federalism that we're supposed to have. Once you think through, well, what's the Constitution supposed to be doing, and you analyze the constitutional structure in that right, it turns out to provide something that modern economists call competitive federalism, although the founders obviously didn't call it that. The general idea here is to mobilize federalism as a means of disciplining government at all levels. And the way that's supposed to happen is you limit the federal government to some domain, and over the remaining domains, you force states to compete. Compete for what? Answer: mobile citizens, mobile firms, mobile capital, and that'll discipline government much more effectively than voting will. We go to the central of elements of what that federalism requires. It requires an enumerated powers doctrine. And the reason is that if the federal government's powers were limitless, there'd be nothing left for the states to compete over. It requires a doctrine that the federal government must govern citizens directly. That is to say, the powers have to be national in their operation, as Madison said. And the reason for that is if they're indirect and if the feds, as in the European Union, govern through the states, you'll face nothing but sort of intergovernmental conspiracies and a running away and escape from political accountability. And the third thing you need, or a third thing that you need, is open borders and a prohibition against tariffs and against extraterritorial and exploitative state regulation. And those rules, of course, are directly in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 10, and in Article 4, in the form of the Privileges and Immunities Clause, and so forth. That federalism held for well over a century, actually. It was called dual federalism, but what I'm emphasizing is the competitive aspects of this kind of federalism. And it was intensely competitive throughout the 19th century, and the Supreme Court saw to it that it remained that way. Now, that federalism, so that's one part of this, constitutional competitive federalism. The exact opposite is something that's now frequently called cooperative federalism, which began its ascent around 1900 during the Progressive Era, and then sailed to victory during the New Deal. And it inverts all the three structural principles that I just mentioned. So the federal powers become limitless. They become indirect. Most of the time, the federal government, there aren't actually that many faceless federal bureaucrats. Most of the time, the feds govern through and with the intermediation of the states. That's true of regulatory programs, which are frequently enforced by states. It's even more true of conditional funds programs, where the states are, or local governments are getting paid by the feds to do the feds' bidding. And states get liberated and unleashed to regulate each other's citizens. And that has a huge advantage for state officials, that those other citizens, unlike their own citizens, can neither run away nor vote the officials out of office. And that, again, is called now cooperative federalism, but again, it's sort of a series of intergovernmental conspiracies, and it's easy to show how that, in fact, drives the growth of government. It doesn't discipline government, rather, as Erwin Chemerinsky says approvingly, it empowers government at all levels. Let me end on sort of one more piece of this picture, which is, why did this happen? And the answer, I think, is not, the Supreme Court collapsed in 1937. That's a consequence of what happened. It's not the cause of what happened. And the reason why this happened is this was not done against the will of the states as states, that is to say, state governments and political elites. It was done at their behest and on their, in response to their demand. And to see how that might happen is, it's intuitive once you come to think of it, and this is James Buchanan's argument, and I think it's been empirically validated, and it's very, very powerful. Think about it. The point of competitive federalism is to discipline state governments, among other things, to make it impossible to exploit their own citizens and to then tax them and give the money to somebody else, because the people who are being taxed will run away. And so states as states hate that and will try to, just like private market producers, they will try to prevent competition and lock themselves into cartels. And in order to do that, and in order to prevent defections, they need the federal government. And so what they want and what they need and what they demanded and began to demand at the beginning of the 19th century is an unlimited government that stands ready to eradicate competition wherever it might rear its head, for example, by means of federal minimum standards, a federal government that liberates states from taxing their own citizens and instead have the feds tax citizens and then send the money back to the states in accordance with some formula. And that's the New Deal federalism. That's our federalism. It's a response to state demand. And if you try to curb it now and wanted to abolish or curb it now, you'd confront a lot of headwind from a lot of states. That form of federalism is enormously resilient. It continues to grow. Contrary to a lot of perceptions, Obamacare is not a centralizing statute. Dodd-Frank is not a centralizing statute. What these statutes do is they seize on the most dysfunctional elements of our federalism and then they double down. The reason why I think we've reached the limits is that we can no longer afford this. Government at all levels now, precisely as in large measure as a result of this form of federalism, is bankrupt. And so states can no longer gamble on, they can no longer sort of overtax and overspend and then hope for the federal government to bail them out because there's no money left. And so that's where the book concludes. I think over the next decade, we will renegotiate our federalism in a very, very fundamental way. The question to my mind is, can you reapproximate something like the original constitutional competitive baseline? I do not know what the answer is, other than maybe. But one thing I know for sure is that we have to get away from this obsession with federal balance and decentralization and all the rest of it and stop asking how much federalism and start asking what kind of federalism and how can we get there. And with that, Michael Rappaport.
Thanks, Michael. I'm very pleased to comment on Michael's new book, The Upside Down Constitution. I first read Michael's book in draft form a couple of years ago at a conference devoted to it, and I continue to read about it in his very interesting posts on the Liberty Fund's Liberty Law blog, where he and I are co-bloggers together. Michael's book is an extremely interesting one that's really just a pleasure to read. But really what stands out most about the book is its distinctive approach. Virtually no one among legal academics has the same approach as Michael. And as a result, I probably learned as much from this book as I have from any book on constitutional law. Today I want to make really just three basic points about Michael's book. First, I want to say a bit about Michael's general approach to constitutional law, which I think is neo-Hamiltonian. And second, I want to argue that Michael has a normatively attractive vision of federalism, one that views federalism as involving competition between the states that protects the welfare of the citizens. And then third, I do want to make one criticism of his book about his view of the spending clause. If he had adopted a different and narrower view of the clause, I think it would have improved significantly the operation of the Constitution based on his own premises. Well, let me start then with Michael's general approach to constitutional law, which, as I say, Michael is a neo-Hamiltonian. At least I think he is. Maybe he'd disagree. He believes in free markets, but unlike most modern federalists, he believes that state governments are the principal impediments to such markets. Since that is an unusual position, he is able to pick a lot of low-hanging fruit and make a large number of original and important points. Let me just give you a couple of examples here. First, he argues in favor, as we heard him mention very briefly, in favor of Swift v. Tyson rather than Erie Railroad. Michael argues that Erie, despite the ordinary assumptions to the contrary, allows forum shopping by plaintiffs who use this power to take advantage of out-of-state corporate defendants. Erie, in other words, is part of the motor of the tort liability explosion. Second, he argues that the full faith and credit clause, that's not one that people often focus on, should be read to impose significant constraints on what one state can do and can take advantage, and the ability of one state to take advantage of its position as the location of a lawsuit. And third, he embraces the dormant commerce clause, which most federalists oppose, as an essential means of combating state protectionism. One of the most striking points that Michael makes is to see the New Deal as, and these are my words, as a cartel machine. The New Deal wasn't just about nationalism. That was a part of what it did. But instead, it was about embracing political cartels and government power. Michael shows us in a host of interesting ways throughout the book. And thus, he showed me another way that the New Deal was a bad thing. I thought my view of the New Deal couldn't get worse. I was wrong. Let me now move to my second point, which is that the attractiveness of the vision of the Constitution that Michael presents in the book, in particular of its federalism. He views federalism, as we saw, as involving the competition between the states, with the federal government operating as a structure to ensure that the competition works well. And he contrasts this with a less attractive vision of federalism as one that protects the powers of the state government. Now, a key issue for Michael is to analyze what's necessary for this competitive structure to operate. And most importantly, it's necessary to prevent the states from exercising their political influence to avoid the competition that the Constitution is supposed to establish. But one distinctive aspect in the book is that Michael believes that this competition requires an active and special role for the Supreme Court. So while most modern federalists, originalists, have argued for Congress to protect the competitive structure by, for example, using the positive commerce clause, Michael argues that the Supreme Court is needed and should use things like the dormant commerce clause. And while I think he makes some pretty good points here, it's not clear to me that the Supreme Court will always or even generally get things right. But maybe it will, especially if scholars like Michael draw a map for the court that explain to it where it needs to go. Well, having explained what I like about the book, let me conclude by mentioning one criticism that I have of it. Michael believes that the Congress has a spending power that allows it to spend money, even if there is no other enumerated power. This is the Hamiltonian interpretation, which allows spending for the general welfare, rather than the Madisonian interpretation, which limits Congress to spending on the enumerated powers. I believe that the Madisonian interpretation would further the competitive federalism that Michael desires, much more than the Hamiltonian interpretation that he embraces, and it would do so in two ways. First, Michael believes that the programs where the federal government raises the funds and then shares those funds with the states, programs such as Medicaid, are a significant problem. And he seems to believe they're a bigger problem than the programs like Medicare, which are exclusively federal. Now, he believes that the states drive such Medicaid funding and make it bigger than it otherwise would be. Well, assuming that that's true, I think the best way to stop such programs is to adopt the Madisonian interpretation, which would prevent the federal government from spending for the general welfare. That would stop federal funding of Medicaid. Instead, the states themselves would have to raise the funds. But there's a second way that the Madisonian interpretation would help with competitive federalism. It would also stop exclusively federal programs such as Medicare and Social Security, which I believe are bigger and worse than Medicaid. Under the Madisonian interpretation, Medicare and Social Security also could not be enacted at the federal level. They would have to occur at the state level. But competitive federalism, without any Supreme Court intervention, would significantly constrain them. If any state sought to redistribute from the young to the old, the way that Medicare or Social Security currently does, if that any state tried to do that, people would leave that state in droves. The problematic features of Medicare and Social Security could not occur if they were required to exist at the state level. It really would be constraints. Thus, I think the Madisonian interpretation of the spending power would solve or address not only Michael's problem with grants to the states, but also with much exclusively federal spending. Somehow, though, Michael misses this opportunity. While he justifies his position in his book as saying that federal spending can sometimes produce net benefits, in the real world, to me at least, the costs are enormous and greatly outweigh the benefits of this federal spending. The only reason, and I say this only half in jest here, that I can figure for why Michael rejects the Madisonian interpretation is that he's a neo-Hamiltonian and can't bear to reject Hamilton's reading. Well, despite this one criticism, let me conclude by repeating really my strong praise for Michael's book. It's essential reading for anyone who views the Constitution as a means of promoting the liberty and wealth of the nation. I'll send it back to you, Dean.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do want to open the floor to audience questions. While we wait for those questions to line up, I want to give Dr. Michael Grieva a chance to respond to Professor Rappaport's comments. Mike, if you have anything to say there.
Sure. Mike, first of all, thanks so much for those generous remarks. And I agree. I don't know how to make this sound plausible. I agree with all of that. You have me exactly right. This is a sort of neo-Hamiltonian version, and to be even more confrontational about it, let's put it this way: this is not an effort to sort of write an accurate history of American federalism. Right? This takes sides. Hamilton and his friends are the good guys. Jefferson and his friends are the bad guys. And so that sort of pervades the entire book. That's not, I mean, and I think for the reasons for that position have to do with my sort of account of the founding and the purpose of the Constitution and the political dynamics of federalism and a whole slew of things. It's not just my current political sympathies. Let's put it that way. That said, yeah, that's right. That is my view. And the spending clause question is, to my mind, really, really hard. Analytically, Mike, I think you're entirely right. If that were the rule, the constitutional rule, that the sort of Madisonian riff on it, it might be the case that we wouldn't have current problem or some of our current problems. I despair, quite frankly, but first of all, my defense of the Hamiltonian position is not just that there's too much water under the bridge or that sometimes it's good to spend money. It is that that's the best way of making sense of the constitutional language and structure, to my mind, one. And second, there's a reason why the structure is the way it is. I mean, even if there are spending limits in the Constitution, and if you want to go with Madison and say it's limited to the enumerated powers, which for complicated reasons, again, I don't think is quite right or can be right, you still confront the question of, well, how would that be different from, you know, what the founders called a parchment barrier? Who's going to enforce that? And that problem would be with you whichever way you you went. And so for a lot of reasons, which you stated very, very well and very powerfully, you know, I wish in some ways that there were sort of a Madisonian spending arrangement. I just can't find it, and I don't think it's sustainable, and I don't think it would be sustainable under any federal system.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Greva. Let's see what's on the minds of our callers. We've got a handful here with questions, so let's go to the first question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. The problem with the way that the Hamiltonian versus Madisonian interpretation of the spending clause has been presented in this forum perhaps needs a little further examination. Clearly, the spending clause, the welfare, more precisely, the general welfare restriction on it, is also mated with the common defense. And defense is not just to exercise one of the enumerated powers. So we could reasonably be conjoined to say that spending is not limited to the exercise of the enumerated powers, but the word general would prohibit redistribution. And therein the focus needs to be put. But my view of federalism is that its main purpose is to provide competition to keep government at all levels constrained to its respective constitutions and to delegated powers there, not just to facilitate industrial or commercial development. But let's focus on solutions, because here we are. Where do we go from here? And is there any place we can go that doesn't involve constitutional amendments, as difficult as they may be? And if so, what amendments could those be? How would we word them? How would we get them adopted?
Dr. Greva, you want to respond?
Yeah, sure. There's a lot, and there's a lot of your caller, excuse me, brought up a lot of very important points, and let me just take a few of them. My general instinct is to shy away from formal constitutional amendments. One, because they tend to be a distraction, because everybody knows how difficult that would be, and so what you frequently do is just sort of give politicians a way to say, "Hey, yeah, I'm with you," without then doing anything that has any traction in the real world. And moreover, I despair of our ability of actually getting constitutional amendments, procedural amendments, especially in the fiscal arena, of getting those right. So just by way of example, California has a lot of the budget restrictions that people have proposed for the federal government and the federal constitution. I would not hold out California governance as a model for the nation, with all due respect. For those reasons, I'm nervous about sort of formal amendments, and I'm much more inclined to think about sort of the political economy of American federalism and what, in the current political context, what could one do and how do the politics shake out. I'd be happy. That's outside the book itself, although if other listeners would like me to pursue that, or if my Rappaport and I want to pursue that, I'd be happy to do so. Let me say a word about the general welfare limitation. That's sort of a soft Hamiltonian position, and I'm inclined to think that it's incoherent. Lots of people try to articulate what exactly a redistributive general welfare limitation would look like and how it would be enforced and what exactly the baseline for that practice would be. That was, in fact, a very, very vivid discussion throughout the antebellum era, and it always foundered on the same problem. You don't know what the baseline of non-redistribution or neutrality is supposed to be, even if you were prepared to sort of read it into the Constitution. What I think, here's a very salient point, and I make this point probably too quickly in the book. I think what led to the explosion, not so much in the federal budget, but eventually in the transfer payments to states, is the income tax. Okay, prior to the progressive amendments, everybody knew where the money for transfers would come from, and that was the federal tariff. And so if you put one of these federal spending programs on the table, it would be financed from a revenue source that was deeply resented by a large part, a large section of the country. That was one. And second, you didn't have these perverse dynamics that said, hey, we took this money from you, and now you might as well claw a piece of it back, right? After you have the income tax, the whole political dynamic changes. And so the federal government or the Congress, where states are represented, right, it puts these programs on the table. They're financed through revenues that come from everywhere. And so every state feels compelled to say, yeah, we have to take the money, among other reasons, because our citizens will pay for these programs one way or the other. Don't get me wrong. I'm not in favor of repealing the income tax amendment. I'm just saying, in terms of the political economy, that's the big shift in the way things work.
If I could just make one point. So if we're talking about constitutional amendments, I actually think that we've got a big problem in getting constitutional amendments. It's a complicated issue. Let me just talk about what I think the biggest problem is, which is, especially in the federalism context, which is that there's no way to get a constitutional amendment that doesn't run through the Congress. And I think Congress is a big part of what needs restraining. So the Congress is never going to propose a line item veto amendment, a balanced budget amendment, a range of different things that one might want. So how does the Constitution was smarter than that. Constitution understood that, and they had an alternative route for constitutional amendments, the convention method, where the states apply for a constitutional convention, and that convention is then held, and then it proposes something, and it goes to the states through ratification. The reason we never get that now in the modern world is because people are fearful, the state legislators are fearful, that if they call a constitutional convention, that convention will come back with a whole bunch of things that they don't like, and then they might end up getting stuck with it. So the system simply doesn't work. It can't produce any amendments. And the biggest part of the problem there is that you can't get a limited convention. You can't get one limited to the things that the states want in their call for the convention it to focus in on. I think that's wrong as a matter of the original meaning of the Constitution. I actually think limited conventions are constitutional. But apart from that, I mean, whatever you think about it, it's just a broken feature of our Constitution. I've got some proposals for how one could change that, but I do very much believe in formal amendments to the Constitution, and I think there's a big problem here in that Congress has got a veto. And until we sort of have an alternative mechanism for adopting constitutional amendments, we're going to have real trouble until, of course, you know, we could have a big, horrible falling off a cliff, and then, of course, the country might have to deal with that, and we'd get some changes. But obviously, you know, we all want to avoid that.
All right, we have a couple more questions lined up here. Let's go to the next question.
Okay, may I proceed?
Please go ahead.
This is James Lucas, timelyrenewed.com. I'm going to carry on this theme of amendment because I think that if you are talking about fundamental constitutional approaches, like Professor Grieve is, I don't see how they can be implemented without going to a structural method. So just a little plug, at my website, I have a specific proposal to reform the amendment process so that states can initiate and enact constitutional amendments without going through Congress, as Professor Rappaport has mentioned. But to now go back to Professor Grieve, setting aside some form of formal amendment, how do you implement your approaches? Or is your book just an analytical analysis to kind of raise our consciousness without specific suggestions as to what a Congress or a state or the political branches might do to implement your perspective?
No, that's a very good question. And no, it's not just analytical, although that is the main focus, and I don't get around to sort of, here's a political reform program. However, this stuff does have implications that are politically salient, and let me mention two of them. I've already alluded to. The system is broke. The country is broke. We will renegotiate the intergovernmental arrangements that we have, whether we want to or not. I don't know which way that is going, but what I hope to do is sort of articulate points and general themes and arguments that might resonate. So, for example, Mike Rappaport mentioned one of my positions. I don't care at the end of the day who runs Medicaid, whether it's wholly federal or wholly state, so long as it's wholly one or wholly the other. What is pernicious about the program and a whole lot of programs like that program is precisely the joint funding and joint responsibility. So to bring this to a point, I am against block grant proposals for Medicaid or anything else, because those will backfire and make the program more, not less expensive, whichever program that is. I am in favor of, so maybe this is something Senator Alexander has proposed, or rather reproposed, separate the functions and separate the programs. Give Medicaid all of it, 100% to the feds, and in return abolish any and all federal education funding and programs. And that would disentangle the programs, and you'd get way less government and way more democracy and accountability in one fell swoop. So that's one very practical application of this. Just to give you a second theme of this, and this I've sort of noodled around with on the website. Mike Rappaport mentioned libertylawsite.org. and here's the general argument. The tendency that I mentioned, that is for states to demand federal cartelization and intervention to prevent and stamp out competition. That's not just the United States. It characterizes every federal system that has ever been in existence in the modern era, with only two exceptions that are very special, Switzerland and Canada. And so the question you want to ask yourself is not, why did that happen in the United States? The question is, why didn't that happen for 100 years? And the answer is that there was a sectional divide that the states could not overcome. Everybody knows what that sectional divide was: slavery and anything touching on slavery, and after the Civil War, Jim Crow. You could not go near that. Any federal proposal that would have endangered the slaveholding system and then the plantation economy and the racial caste system in the South was stillborn, and there were enough states to resist any federal proposal that would have interfered with that system in the South. Needless to say, nobody wants, so the short version of that is sectionalism is a powerful protection for federalism. Now, needless to say, nobody wants slavery and Jim Crow back. However, you look at the modern era, and there are, in recent years, more and more questions on which states are split. It's not the feds versus the states. It's states split among themselves. So you look at the Obamacare litigation, it's 26 states against Obamacare and 12 vehemently for it. You look at the global warming regulations that come out of the EPA, it's the same 26 states or minus a few against the same dozen states on the other side. You look at labor regulation, for example, the hubbub over Boeing's intentions to buy a plant, to build a plant in South Carolina, and the larger theme of union versus non-union states. It's the same lineup of states, and that's before. And there are other issues like that, and that is all before you get to, you know, gay marriage and abortion and all the rest of it. So the long and short of it is, sectionalism is making a real comeback in American politics, because there are now maybe 15, 16, 18 states led by Texas and Virginia that say to themselves or have discovered there's nothing in it for us in this cartelized federalism. So long as that system governs, we cannot do what we want to do, which is to play to our competitive advantages. The feds will always stop us, and they will do it at the behest of these loser states like California and New York and Illinois. And that's a real hope for federalism, it seems to me. If you can mobilize that state coalition coherently and say, okay, here's a way we want the world to look like, and we will agitate for programs that fit into our vision, our competitive constitutional vision, and we will block any and all proposals that interfere with it, you have a good game going. So I would not throw in the towel on ordinary politics altogether.
Professor Rappaport, you want to comment here?
One suggestion that I do have, and this might get me a little bit close to Michael's criticisms of California, but I actually think that if a big part of the problem is federal action, and I think one possible solution is to require things like supermajorities to pass certain kinds of legislation, problematic legislation. Obviously, that's not a popular proposal now with most people, but that is one way of kind of having a self-enforcing mechanism for preventing certain laws from getting passed. Now California does have there's still a couple left, but not that many, certain supermajority rules, but they were set up in bad ways that created some problems. I don't want to go into the details now, but if you couldn't get something passed, then everything had a problem. They didn't have any ways for dealing with situations when you couldn't get the supermajority. But there are ways of dealing with that. And so I actually think, however popular or unpopular it might be, that one of the ways of constraining the federal government would be to have certain supermajority rules for certain things like debt, or I would actually even propose it for spending. But I think Michael is quite right and insightful in pointing out that sectionalism is a very powerful force. And if you can sort of harness that force in the right way, that can do a lot of good.
Okay, we still have three more people with questions, so let's move on to the next question.
Yes, this is Ramon Bueller with the Madison Coalition. I noticed that people talked about ways in which to empower states without a constitutional amendment. There's an argument that the real power of the states is in Article 5, and I agree with Professor Rappaport that you can't use it because of the risk of a runaway convention. What do the two of you think of the idea of states passing a state law that would limit the authority of their delegates to an up or down vote on one amendment, and a state constitutional amendment that would prohibit that state from ratifying any amendment from a convention that the states who called it didn't authorize? Presumably those laws and those constitutional amendments could give back the states the power that Madison intended them to have to at least threaten Congress with an amendment and therefore restore some of the power that Madison intended some of the states to have.
Dr. Grieva, you want to take that one?
No, I defer to Mike as the as the amendment expert.
Professor,
I mean, go ahead.
Go ahead, Michael.
No, I was going to say my response would be purely tactical and situational. I just don't think we have the time. I think I'm serious. I mean,
I'm not disagreeing. It's a scary laugh. It's a laugh in the graveyard. Not a disagreement. So I'm sympathetic with that. I've actually written a couple of articles, and one of them is a proposal of how we could of what the new arrangement could look like that would basically give the states the ability to sort of write a constitutional amendment ahead of time, and then we would then have an approval of that amendment at the ratification stage. So we'd never even have a constitutional convention. I think that's the best way of avoiding the runaway convention problem. And as I said, I actually think that a limited convention, and by that what I mean is the states, when they apply for a convention, say, we want this convention to be about balanced budgets only. Or maybe they even say, we want this convention simply to vote on the following balanced budget amendment. That's it, up or down. That's all the convention can do. I actually think those are constitutional. So slightly different than the way that the caller pointed out about having a state constitutional amendment, which it's not at all clear that would be constitutionally okay. It might or might not. But I'm very sympathetic with the same approach. I've got some suggestions in particular. There's an article in the Virginia Law Review, if you want to look online under my name, you'll be able to find it pretty quickly. But I'm very sympathetic with that, although the exact points I'm not as sure about.
Okay, two more questions. We've got about five more minutes, so I think we'll have time for these final two questions. Go ahead, caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It would seem that at this point in our history, we are probably not going to avoid a general economic collapse worldwide. I think it's probably too late for that. Not only is it politically infeasible to do anything that might prevent it, but there just isn't time. People are not yet aware enough, nor do they have sufficiently worked out plans of action. But let me suggest that perhaps it would be useful for us to lay the foundation for a recovery, to begin planning for the aftermath, because if we don't, we're liable to have a world descending into fascism. And those of us who believe in constitutional republican government need to have plan in place for reforms, including constitutional amendments, that people could rally around and thereby build a recovery upon. And let me challenge those present. I think that those of us who have thought most about this, the main leading legal scholars, really need to get together in some kind of conference to hammer out specific proposals.
Do you have a question?
I've been doing a lot of that, but is anyone here willing to lead in organizing the leading legal scholars to just to meet on the subject of hammering out constitutional amendments?
Dr. Grivo or Mike Rappaport, you want to respond?
I'll pass.
Mike Rappaport, you?
The only thing that I would say, rather than respond to the specific question, is I am not quite nearly as pessimistic, and I just have one brief reason for one example of why I'm not nearly so pessimistic, and that is Canada. 5 years ago, I used to just think of Canada, with their socialized medicine and their anti-Americanism and so on, in a kind of negative way. And now Canada is a economically freer place in the United States, in much better shape, despite their socialized medicine. And it was all done sort of politically. right? So and gradually, and it was really in a lot of ways a blueprint. So if the Canadians can do it, then maybe we can as well.
All right, we have time.
Not leave the wrong impression about where I stand. Look, privately, we all, upon reading the newspapers or the blogs, sort of swing from despair to hopelessness and back again. My position on it is that, look, moments of great danger are always moments of great opportunity as well. And the truth of the matter is nobody really knows how this will shake out. It depends on what actual human beings do in the future. So what this book ends on, at least, and that's my position by which I stand, is that in moments when things seem unsettled in lots of threatening ways, it's also true that a lot of things become thinkable and doable that in calmer, more sedate times look like completely off the wall.
All right, let's take our final question.
This is Mark Scarberry, Pepperdine Law School. Thanks for this great teleform. Quick question. I wonder if either of you would like to expand on the role of the administrative state in these matters, with it being, in a sense, the opposite of a supermajority, cutting out Congress, lack of accountability, it's further from the states, those sorts of matters.
Yeah, that's a huge question. What the administrative state hangs together with federalism in a whole lot of complicated ways. That's a very important first point. And the second observation about it is that it shares one big feature with our federalism, which is precisely it exists to make political conspiracies and bargains easier, to reduce the transaction costs, right? If it's too complicated to sort of constantly pass legislation and get the president to sign off on it, dump it all into some administrative agency, let them haggle it out, it's an intergovernmental arrangement, just as our federalism, except sort of in a horizontal dimension. And it has me every bit as worried in a whole lot of ways as our federalism. It's something that I intend to teach and think and write about in the future. It's somewhat outside the book, but not because I think it's not important or salient. It's just because the book is already 400 pages long and endless footnotes. I had to stop someplace.
Yeah, so let me just add, I agree with everything that Michael said there, and I just would want to add, I think we actually have certain reform proposals that could do a lot of good in this area, but once again, for the reasons that Michael mentioned, Congress would be the last institution to want to adopt them. So,
yes.
So for example, something along the lines of the RAINS Act, or some where basically regulations would be proposed by administrative agencies, and then the Congress would have to vote up or down on them with, let's say, a roll call vote. That's very doable. It would change the practice in Washington, but it wouldn't upset. It's a practical proposal, but every single congressman would resist it, tooth and nail. So it's the kind of thing that you could only get through maybe even a constitutional amendment through the state process, but not through the Congress.
Dr. Grieve, let me give you a chance to express a final thought.
My final thought is thank you again, especially to Mike Rappaport and to you, Dean, for setting it up. I've enjoyed this tremendously, and I hope our listeners have as well.
Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, then, I do want to thank Professor Michael Rappaport and Dr. Michael Grieve. We've been discussing his book, The Upside Down Constitution, which is available at Amazon, but also a link to that page is available on the Federalist Society's website. Thank you both for joining us today. Thank you also to our audience. We are adjourned. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org
/multimedia.